Yeah, I mean, it was close to saying goodbye to this earth. And, you know, fortunately, I made it through. And I remember getting back into rehab. And then I met a state rehab counselor who said, you know, Mark, you have this great love, this great passion for the outdoors. Why don't you become a park ranger? And I'm thinking, man, how's somebody in a wheelchair going to be a park ranger?
It's easy to talk about our triumphs, but what doesn't get talked about enough is the struggle. My name is Eric Weinmayer. I'm an adventurer. I've climbed Mount Everest and the seven summits, the tallest peak in every continent, and I happen to be blind. This is the No Barriers Podcast.
On today's show, we meet Mark Wellman, a nationally acclaimed author, filmmaker, and motivational speaker. Despite being paralyzed in a mountain climbing accident, Mark has inspired millions to meet their problems head-on and reach for their full potential. A two-time Paralympian and a former Yosemite park ranger, Mark's No Limits philosophy encourages individuals to adventure into new horizons and to go beyond the seeming unreachable. He shares his story in his autobiography, Climbing Back. He's an accomplished wheelchair athlete. He's best known for the first paraplegic ascents of the sheer granite faces of El Capitan and Half Dome in Yosemite National Park. His notoriety has been acclaimed on national television by congressional commendation and meetings with two U.S. presidents. The first paraplegic to sit ski unassisted across the Sierra Nevada mountain range, March has also carried the flaming torch up a 120-foot rope and lit the cauldron for the opening of the Paralympic Games in Atlanta.
Well, welcome to our No Barriers podcast. We are thrilled today to have Mark Wellman with us, who's one of the founders of No Barriers. Can't wait to hear some of his stories about what this organization was founded upon. He's really the heart and soul behind why many of us are here at the organization.
And I am totally thrilled. This is great. I'm so psyched to have my friend, all our friends, Mark Wellman on the podcast today.
The legend,
the dirt bag. Is that okay to say?
Yeah, yes.
You embrace it, right?
It's great to be here. I embrace everything.
Mark almost doesn't need an introduction, but I mean, Mark is a world-class adventurer, is the key founder of No Barriers, and has done amazing things that blow your mind as an adventurer, has skied across the Ruth Gorge, has traversed the Sierra Nevada mountain range, has mountain biked the White Rim Trail, has climbed El Capitan, Half Dome. We were just talking this morning, what your Half Dome ascent was 13 days.
Yeah, it was.
On the wall. Yeah. So just, you know, Mark, I mean, a hero of mine for sure. And you're a few years older than me. So when I was a teenager and you were just a little bit older climbing El Capitan and doing all these amazing adventures, you are a huge part of my motivation. So, I'm psyched right now.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks a lot, Eric. 35 years ago, I was an able-bodied climber, and we were climbing a peak called Seven Gables, which is pretty close to the Mount Whitney area. And we had a 20-mile backpack to get into the base. And this was back in 1982. I was 22 years old. My good friend Peter Ensminger and I were back there to do this climb, and we set up a base camp about 10,000 feet, and the next morning we got up pretty early, you know, grabbed our technical rock climbing equipment and left most of our provisions at the base camp, our sleeping bags. Sure would have been nice to have that sleeping bag with us, but I didn't have it. And we climbed the Seven Gables. It was a sort of technical, kind of mixed kind of route. There was a little bit of ice, a little bit of rock, and made the ascent. And by the time we topped out, it was a little bit late in the afternoon, about 5 o'clock, and we just embraced this beautiful view from the summit. And the American Alpine Club places sometimes these cairns or climbing registers at the top of the mountain. And it was kind of cool to see this. And in this case, it was just a pile of rocks with a Folgers coffee can.
Right.
And I opened up the Folgers coffee can and dumped out the little pieces of paper. And there was my hero, Royal Robbins, had climbed it.
Wow.
I'm cool, man. I'm going to put my name next to Royal. And, you know, did that. And then we decided we're going to go down a class 4 descent on the backside, just scrambling, not roped. We were just kind of walking down a talus slope. I'll be the first to kind of admit that my guard was down. My partner said, hey, you know, maybe we should put a rope on, right, this one section here. I'm going, no, I want to get down to the base camp. I'm really hungry. There's some really good freeze-dried food I want to eat. Which, you know, that wonderful mountain house stuff.
Yeah, and 35 years
delicious.
Ago.
Yeah. It was half what it is now. So next thing I knew, I slipped on some scree, and I kind of pitched forward, and I started rolling, and I made a couple somersaults, and then I rolled off about a 100-foot cliff. And when I landed, I broke my lower back at T11, T12. Of course, at the time, I didn't know. I was 22. I didn't even know what a wheelchair was. That happened, and my partner thought I possibly could have been killed, but he heard me yell back at him, and then he got down to where I was. He said he spent a couple hours with me stopping some bleeding on my legs. And
what's your recollection of that period of time?
He said he was with me for 2 hours. It felt like 10 minutes.
Right.
And then he left, and he left an orange and an extra jacket and some trail mix and said, man, I got to get out and get some help. After 30 hours, the best sound I've ever heard in my whole life was the sound of this whoop, 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 whoop coming up the canyon.
You almost froze to death.
It was cold that night. Yeah, it was real cold. I was laying on some ice, and that probably helped because it kept the swelling down in my back.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm an incomplete para, so I have a little bit of movement in my legs. So they said that might have helped me, the swelling. The helicopter got up there. It actually was a ship from the Forest Service. They were going to just go up and see if it was like more of a body recovery. But fortunately, I waved to them, and then the helicopter disappeared. About an hour later, a second helicopter came up, and this time it was from Lemoore Navy Base. And they did a technical rescue, flew in, brought the rotors within several feet of the cliff surface, lowered a Navy medic, got me in a Stokes litter, got me back up in the ship, and I was down at a trauma center. They were cutting my clothes off, and a nurse said, who's your insurance company? And fortunately, I did have insurance. I had Kaiser, and I went through stabilization of my back with Harrington rods, and I was in the hospital in 1982 for 7 months.
Hmm. Wow.
Including rehab?
Including rehab and the whole nine yards. And nowadays, a paraplegic, if you go to Craig Hospital, it's kind of the factory up here in the West, a paraplegic will be in the hospital for about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty dramatic to, you know, in those days, it was a much longer hospitalization,
right?
Learning how to take care of yourself. And then I met
more time is better, right? I mean, it would make sense, right?
You can devote more time. Yeah, a little bit. I think 7 months was a little excessive.
Right.
You know, there's a lot to learn. Your life has really changed. Your spinal cord runs your body, and you're paralyzed from your waist down. You have bowel and bladder issues, skin issues you have to be careful about. So all those things were really important. And I had this one physical therapist who was from Germany, and she goes, you need to train like you're training for the Olympics. I just really took that to heart and started lifting weights and was ambulating with long leg braces. And this was sort of the beginning of the wheelchair revolution, where wheelchairs weren't a stale piece of medical equipment. They were a lightweight piece of aluminum that was more of an extension of your body. Hmm. And the wheelchair could take you from point A to point B. And fortunately, in 1982 is really when these wheelchairs, they started making lightweight chairs. And right. I was part of that.
We're still less than 10 podcasts in here, but you know, we've already heard a lot of stories of people, these no barrier stories of people who go down deep, you know, into these dark places. So I don't want to, you know, bring you down, but I mean, you have a lot of experience right now. And so you can look back. I mean, you went to a dark place, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, it was close to saying goodbye to this earth. And, you know, fortunately, I made it through. And I remember getting back into rehab. And then I met a state rehab counselor who said, you know, Mark, you have this great love, this great passion for the outdoors. Why don't you become a park ranger? I'm thinking, man, how's somebody in a wheelchair going to be a park ranger? I'm thinking law enforcement, search and rescue. And she goes, no, you know, there's many hats in the National Park Service, many different jobs. She took me down to Fort Funston, where I met a ranger who kind of showed me the ropes and said, hey, you know, you could maybe do a job. You know, this would be an entry-level position, but you could help us plant dune grass and work in the nursery, or you could go to the entrance gate and help out there. So I did that for a summer, and then I went back to school and went to West Valley College and studied park management.
Cool.
And became a ranger in Yosemite. And I remember my first job wasn't exactly my idea of being a ranger. There I was sitting in this little kiosk, this little booth at Big Oak Flat, the entrance to Yosemite. And in those days, a $3 entrance fee, and I'd collect the money and be breathing in auto fumes all day long. And that really wasn't my idea of being a ranger. But it was an entry level. The next summer, I went down to Yosemite Valley and started working at the visitor center, doing interpreting the natural processes of the park to the public, bear management, geology. Climbing was a big subject, too. I'd give programs on climbing and talk about aid climbing versus free climbing. And
Were you transparent with the people who would come through the park with how your injury took place when you talk about the
biology? I was. I would start my climbing program off with my accident, actually, yeah, and bring that in, because I think that was a kind of a big part of it. They might say, well, who's this guy in a wheelchair? What does he know about climbing? So I'd kind of bring that in. That was before I climbed El Cap. Mm-hmm. I was doing those.
Were you percolating on something like that when you were there?
I was. You know, it's kind of an interesting story. There was a magazine called Sports and Spokes. It's a wheelchair athletic magazine. And on the front cover of that magazine was a DSUSA chapter, a woman who was being lowered down a cliff in a wheelchair on a river rafting trip. And the river went over a waterfall, and they needed to portage all the equipment around the waterfall. And they had a swami belt and a climbing rope, and they had a helmet. I guess they wanted to put a helmet on her for safety. Sounded like a good idea. And they lowered her down this cliff in this wheelchair, and it was on the front cover of this magazine, Sports and Spokes. And I got the magazine at my little cabin in Yosemite, and I had it on my lap, and I was wheeling over to the visitor center to open it up in the morning, and I bumped into my future climbing partner, Mike Corbett. And Mike's nickname was Mr. El Cap back in the 80s. He had climbed El Cap more than anybody else in the world, over 50 times.
Wow.
And Mike had never really talked about climbing to me because they knew that's how I got hurt. But when I showed him this picture, Mike's eyes got really big and he got really excited. He goes, you know what, Mark? I want to start climbing with you, but what I really want to do is climb El Cap. And we had no idea how we were going to do it. That evening, we were sitting at the Mountain Room bar. We might have had a beer or two.
Or three.
We're all good decisions.
You know, where all good decisions are made. So we had a little beer napkin, and we started writing down notes, and we said, okay, we're going to take a Jumar. A Jumar is to rope ascenders. This was back in the day, kind of like what Kleenex is to tissue. So we took a Jumar, and we mounted a pull-up bar on a Jumar, and then we had a second ascender on a chest harness, and we put a rope up in... right by the Iwani Hotel, Church Bowl Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an oak tree. We had this rope, and we started ascending up into the tree, and then he'd lower me back down. So we go, okay, well, so a paraplegic can ascend a rope using their upper body strength. Now, to get on El Capitan, we got to actually protect your lower extremities from the granitic rock, because we knew we were going to be up there at least a week. And if I don't have feeling in my legs... So I really needed to protect my legs from any kind of abrasion or any kind of sore that could have occurred up there. We went down to this hardware store in Fresno, California, outside the park. We bought some leather, a Speedy Stitcher, some closed cell insulation foam, and we just started making these rock chaps, and they just sort of evolved over a course of 6 months. And we were climbing Jam Crack, Warner's.
Weren't they like, what were was the material of those? I felt your chaps before. That's
the original. Well,
the truth comes out. Hey, we're all friends here.
Yeah. The original rock chaps were actually made out of leather and canvas.
Oh, okay.
But the pair of rock chaps you felt were actually made out of some kind of silky material.
Fur.
No.
Oh, that was lingerie.
Yeah,
it was velvet.
Chaps.
This was the first No Barriers improv meeting, right? What you're talking about. With your buddy Mike.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was it. That was like the genesis of what, like, fast forward to today. That was the beginning. And what year was that? 1980?
That was 1988.
88.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah, 88. I was 28 years old.
So if you think about it that way, No Barriers began in the Awani bar.
Yeah, out of Barstool.
Out of Barstool.
Yeah,
so on a bar napkin.
I know you guys are all dirtbag climbers. I'm not a dirtbag climber. For our listeners who are not dirtbag climbers, someone paint a picture, because we're getting into the LCAP story, which is just a phenomenal story. Paint a picture of LCAP for us, because not everyone knows what that is.
Yeah, well, LCAP is probably the most revered, iconic monolith in North America, if not the world. Uninterrupted, over 3,000 feet of granite. And it is, when you're in Yosemite, you look up at it, and it's got this perfectly symmetrical flank apron on both sides that comes out into this promontory called the nose. You can't take your eyes off of it. If you look away for a minute, you have to look back at it, just because it's just so magnificent and powerful, and it represents so much too. And it's sort of, if you want to call yourself a climber, you kind of have to climb El Cap, you know, at some point. So
when you stand in the meadows below, which is just clogged with tourists just all driving by gawking, what I've heard is you have to look up and up and up and up and up, like way higher than you think you have to.
Yeah, and if you see a person climbing, as a person who's not a technical climber speaking, you think those people are crazy.
Yeah.
What are they doing up there?
Eric and I climbed El Cap, and his dad, Eric's dad and future wife, were down in the meadow with like telescopes and watching us, and we had little, you know, one of those little like lighty things, little like... sticks, and we were shining our headlamps down at everybody. But it's a magnificent thing, but it's also very intimidating.
Yeah.
It can be really cool when you stand up at it and look at it, but then the idea of going and climbing it, I think, is a whole different story.
And as a quote-unquote gimp.
Absolutely.
And that's a word, by the way, that Mark taught me. I've never even heard that word before. It's one of those words, I guess, you somehow have the license to use if you are blind.
Yeah.
So when you talked about this out loud, what did people think? Mm-hmm. Like, are people like, you're nuts?
We had kind of a mixture of both. People that knew us well were, oh yeah, you guys should go do this. You know, Mark's been training. He's always skiing. He's always riding his bike, hand bike around. In those days, it was more of a row cycle. And then we had people say, mainly not to me so much, but more to Mike, are you crazy to take this paraplegic guy up El Cap? Seems like a really stupid idea. You know, something could go wrong. But fortunately, you know, we didn't really listen to that. We just started training. We made these rock chaps. Like I said, they kind of just evolved over about a six-month period. We kind of had a little circuit in Yosemite Valley that we climbed together. We did Jam Crack, the Prude, Warner's Crack, the Rostrum. We went over there.
Oh, wow.
So we did, you know, we did some stuff in the valley just to kind of really warm up. And then I actually went up and spent a night on El Cap because we wanted to feel what that was like.
Up at Sickle?
We actually went to Heart Ledge.
Wow.
Over on the south.
So, yeah, over on the south. We were going to climb, the route we were going to climb was the Shield. So,
because it's overhanging.
It was overhanging, yeah. Once you get over the Shield roof, it's overhanging. The beginning of it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty low angle.
Were you scared at all before you did this, or were you just super fired up and kind of naive?
I was scared the night before.
You were?
Yeah.
Like really scared?
Yeah, I was like, couldn't sleep. This is kind of what happened was, really, Mike, about 2 weeks before we were going to blast off, Mike goes, man, we've trained so hard for this. I'm going to write a letter to Tom Brokaw, who was the national NBC news guy, who was a climber too, a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm going, okay. I go, so basically Corbett just wrote out a note with a pencil. He was a janitor at the Yosemite Medical Clinic to support his habit of his addiction to climbing. And he just wrote a little note to Tom Brokaw, and I think like 3 or 4 days later, he's talking to Tom Brokaw, called the medical clinic, and talked to Mike, and said, we want to come out and do this story.
Gosh.
And all of a sudden, the pressure was on. And that's when I really was thinking, wow, you're going to tell national news. This is going to be kind of add a lot more pressure for myself. But, you know, as soon as we got to the base of El Cap and I touched that granite, all that training and preparation really came into par. I got relaxed and I started doing pull-up after pull-up, dragging myself up the largest unbroken granite cliff in North America, El Capitan. And the first night, we do something called we fix pitches. So we were fixed up about 800 feet. So we had, and Mike used to say, you know, it's always nice to kind of have a jump start.
Right.
You know, fix those lines, get all your water. Mm-hmm. You know, we had 250 pounds.
It's like a trail of ropes that go up 800 feet so you can just
the next morning
start on the ground and zip up 800 feet and have like a jump start on this gigantic monolith.
And have all your water, all your gear up there. You know, so he had to work 3 or 4 days to make that happen prior to us leaving. Once we left Mammoth Terrace, we were on our own. You know, we went through the gray ledges, and then we went over. The roof was really tremendous because Mike is basically climbing upside down, gets up onto the pitch above it, and fixes a rope. I kind of untied myself and I swing underneath that roof and you could hear the cheers of the people down below. Just like what Jeff was saying, it's quite a scene at the El Cap Meadow. I mean, you really have to have binoculars. It's hard to see climbers up there because they're so tiny. They're like little ants up there. If you don't know what to look for, it's hard to see these people. But the crowd was yelling and the Green Dragon come by. It's a tour vehicle that has its open-air shuttle. And they would be...
If you look upright, you will see a nutcase.
Exactly. Well, they were squawking about our climb. We could actually hear them talking about Mike Corbett, Mark Wellman, first paraplegic. So that was kind of interesting. And then finally, when we topped out, it was 7 nights, 8 days of climbing. This was before digital technology on El Cap, when national news came out. So they had a mule train. They brought out a satellite dish that was like 5 feet wide. And we were live on top of El Cap talking to Tom Brokaw. We got like between the Today Show and NBC News. In a week, we were on TV for like, I want to say several hours. If you took all the time that they played this. And as soon as we got off that climb, about a week later, we're sitting in the Oval Office talking to President Bush.
Wow.
And it was myself, Mike Corbett, Rittenour, who was Secretary of the Interior, and Jack Moorhead, Superintendent of Yosemite. The four of us are in the White House in the Oval Office talking about bone fishing because President Bush loved to bone fish. Mm-hmm. And we presented him with a flag that we took with us on the climb.
That's incredible.
And it changed my life.
Mark, I mean, so you're not that old, but I see you literally as like the sort of the father of adventure sports for people with disabilities. I want people to understand that like the idea to climb El Cap back in the 80s. I mean, nowadays, I think how many people have climbed El Cap in chairs, paras?
Oh, they're
dozens,
chairs,
right?
Yeah, dozens.
But that you sort of unleashed that. You like opened up this door. And now, you know, quote unquote, gimps are like doing everything, right?
Every summer there's a paraplegic.
But you open that door for all of us. I mean, so
yeah,
it's sort of a crazy thought to me.
You can't take that, the first ascent of El Cap, you can't take that away from me. And that's something I'll always remember. It was a huge accomplishment for both Mike and I. And there's been different paraplegics have gone up it. The gentleman with cerebral palsy, Steve Wampler, was probably the most disabled person that's been up there. So, you know, everybody has their differences. And there's been a quadriplegic, an incomplete quadriplegic, climbed El Cap with Tommy Thompson, a good climber, and Steve Muse.
And there's that kid who climbed the Chief. He was inspired by you.
Yeah.
He was a quad, and he climbed the Chief. He invented kind of this... It's almost like a contraption with wheels, if I remember right, that kind of rolled up the face.
Yeah, the premise was taking the Dolt cart. A climber by the name of Dolt had this cart and you used to use it for hauling system on El Cap. Well, Brad Zaczynski, the Canadian guy you're talking about, he came up with this kind of cart. His hands didn't really work as well as a paraplegic. He's lost some muscle mass in his hands and fingers. So he had a different type of system where he could ascend a rope using a crank and develop that. So there's been all kinds of different adaptations that allow people that are wheelchair users to go rock climbing.
This sort of set you on this course to being an improvisational pioneer, and those are my words. Were you like that always, or do you feel like your accident then sort of queued you up for this opportunity to then, over the past 35 years, now you've continued this trajectory of being this pioneer when it comes to just making it work. You make it work, right?
I was so young. I mean, when I got hurt, I was 22. I wasn't climbing big walls. I hadn't got to that point yet of climbing El Cap. You know, finally, when I did have my accident, it kind of made sense. The steeper the climb for somebody in a chair, the better.
Yeah, yeah.
Mountaineering is going to be really tough. There are ways of doing mountaineering. I mean, we got four paraplegics on top of Mount Shasta.
Yep.
And there was a guy named Pete Reike. It's funny, with people come, they come to me. If they got an idea, a lot of times they want me to be part of the project.
Mm-hmm. That was like a pod that they were in that had like almost like tractor wheels, right?
Exactly. It was what we did is we took a snowmobile and cut the snowmobile track in half and made a tractor stance. So you have two tracks and a seat with a bicycle crank. And we actually cranked our way up Mount Shasta. And we had to get special permit from the Forest Service. You can only be on Shasta for 3 days. And we knew we were going to be up there for a week.
Yeah.
So I had to drive up. I was trying to explain to this district ranger on the telephone. He really wasn't getting it.
Sometimes they don't get it.
He wasn't getting it at all. He was thinking, you know, mechanical device. Right. And so I go, he knew who I was. So he said, yeah, come up and bring the machine with you so I can take a look at it. So I brought one of the snow pods up there and I met with the district ranger and a couple of his backcountry rangers. And they got it. You know, they said, this is cool, man. We'd like to let you guys do this. They gave us a special use permit. The big thing about the Forest Service in wilderness or National Park Service wilderness, you cannot take, supposedly mechanized devices cannot go into the wilderness. But if you have a disability, you know, your bicycle could almost be considered a wheelchair.
Right.
Or your snow pod can be considered a wheelchair, long as it doesn't have a Briggs & Stratton engine on it. Mm-hmm. So that was the big thing. It has to be a manual piece of a gear that's human powered. We got that, and we got four paraplegics on top of Mount Shasta.
And El Cap really like launched you into being able to do all these amazing things, right? You pretty much became a professional climber adventurer doing these things around the world. I know you lit the torch for the Paralympics, right?
I did. I lit the Paralympic torch in Atlanta in 1996. Muhammad Ali lit it for the Able-Bodied Olympics, and they had this torch, and the night before we're training for it, you know, that it's a big surprise, right? They don't want to see the person light the torch the night before. No media, so we're out there, and I was going to climb an 80-foot rope, doing rope ascension, doing pull-up after pull-up, and North Face made me a little kind of we kind of envisioned sort of this Robin Hood thing with the, behind my shoulders, this arrow quiver where I put the actual torch in, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to burn my hair, what's left of it.
So, you had a lot more in the air. Yeah. Yeah.
So they said, well, let's make this kind of this torch holder so it comes off your legs. Uh-huh. So they made that for me. So that night we're training, and I get up the 80-foot rope, and I lit the fuse, and the fuse blew out.
Oh, no.
And the pyrotechnics guy goes, it was windy, and the next day it was going to be windy, too. So the pyrotechnics guy goes, okay, Mark, I'll make sure this fuse doesn't go out the night you do it. And I go, great. So I get up there in front of 80,000 people. I'm climbing up this rope. Liza Minnelli's singing this song, and she's going, go, Mark, go, Mark. And the whole stadium of 80,000 people is going nuts. So I lit this fuse, and literally the thing blew up. There was like fire all over me, and I'm like leaning back, hoping I'm not going to catch on fire. And then the fuse went up and lit the actual cauldron, and that was the start of the 1996 Summer Olympics.
You did not combust.
I did not combust. I had the best seat in the house.
You'd be like a Motley. You'd be like a Motley Crue drummer.
Yeah, exactly. You would have been. Wow. So that was fun, and
take us on a little like tour of what you did, like all those amazing adventures that you did after that. Because a little tour around the world.
What a lot of people don't realize, which I think is harder than climbing El Cap, or spending 13 days on Half Dome, was another big ascent we did years ago, but was doing the Trans Sierra ski crossing. I've done it twice now. I did it in 1993, was a big winner, and I did it in 2011. So we took a cross-country Nordic sit ski. You sit low to the ground, you have two skis mounted underneath a frame with a seat, and you're sitting maybe a foot off the snow, and you have two poles, and you actually double pole. So you're double poling to make this device go down the trail. I was on the U.S. Disabled Nordic ski team, competed in two Paralympics in France and in Norway, got beat up by the Finns and Norwegians. I mean, they're so passionate about that sport.
And they're Vikings.
Yeah. Man. They're so tough.
Yeah.
My best finish out of 30 guys was a fifth place in that was in France. And then in Norway, I just didn't got even more beat up. I wanted to actually get into Nordic ski racing because I had other things that I wanted to do. I wanted to try to get into the backcountry in a Nordic ski. Back in 93, a guy named Jeff Pagels and myself was also on the U.S. Disabled Nordic team. We took sleds, little pulks, behind our rigs where we had our bivy gear, and we skied 55 miles from Snowline on the east side of the Sierra on the Tioga Road.
We got
someone to open up the gate, guy that worked for the power company, opened up the gate. We got up to Snowline, and we skied from Snowline to Crane Flat, which is 55 miles following the Tioga Road.
Just the two of you?
Well, we also had Perlman with us too.
Filming.
He was filming it.
And what? And you got to tell the story about the White Rim. So you bike the White Rim. I think you were on one-off like mountain bikes.
Yeah.
Some kind of devices, hand crank mountain bikes. And then it was so sandy, the story I heard. You had to get out and you had to pretty much pull yourself on your arms and pull your chair. Did you pull the other guy's chairs too? Or the other guy's... bikes
it was
well,
an or? It was an epic groveling adventure. It seems like everything I do turns into a grovel.
Suffer
you know,
fest.
If you're not suffering, you're not having a good time.
That's right.
It's kind of how it is out there. Yeah, we had these one-off mountain bikes, and we actually did a Jeep tour to kind of check it out a couple years prior. We did have it a little easier. We didn't carry all our water and food with us. We had a swag wagon out there. So a Suburban, follow the three paraplegics, myself, Bob Vogel, and Steve Ackerman. We rode this, 52 miles is the full circumnav of the White Rim. And there was times, it was a kind of an interesting experience out there because some of these washes were like moon dust, man. We couldn't get our bikes through it. So I had a pair of rock chaps with me, and I threw the rock chaps on and did some crawling and had an 11 mil static rope and dragged the guys behind me and did a few epic things like that.
I mean, if I'm riding my mountain bike and I come up on that scene in the middle of the White Rim, who knows what to make of that? Like,
you can walk, man. Yeah. So the best thing to do is just walk your bike.
Like, you guys are good, right?
We just do
like, right. Yep, we're good, man. Yeah.
Leave us alone.
Leave us alone.
Don't touch
There's
me.
There's nothing to see here.
Yeah.
Wow, that's rad.
And then recently, which I did just a couple years ago, in the winter, we had a drought in California and Tahoe. So I circumnabbed Lake Tahoe in a kayak in the winter. And that was a really amazing adventure. It was 72 miles, two nights of camping. But the cool thing was, and it was cool at night, it was really cold at night, but there was no power boats. In the winter, you don't have any power boats on Lake Tahoe. It was kind of like being out there in the 1800s, seeing bald eagles, and none of the tourists were on the water. It was just really a fantastic trip.
So Mark, you are someone who really embodies the spirit of No Barriers, and you help start the organization. So tell us, you have all these adventures, all these things you've done to challenge what's possible, what people think is possible. Why No Barriers? Tell us that story.
my wife and I, we were down in San Francisco at a fundraiser. In those days, it was called Yosemite Fun. Now it's called Yosemite Conservancy. We were at this dinner, and I met this kind of wild old character named Jim Goldsmith. We started talking. Then he had a cabin in the subdivision I live in called Tahoe Donner. Jim and I and Carol and his wife Connie would get together. We had a couple dinners together. And then Jim started talking about the Dolomites and his son-in-law and daughter. And he said, man, it'd be really neat to kind of do something for disabled people and able-bodied people if we did something in the Dolomites. And I go, man, I know a couple guys who I've done some stuff with, a guy named Hugh Herr, double amputee, who's done some rock climbing with him, and Eric Weinmeier. And this was probably after your Everest
climb. Yeah, after.
This was after your mm-hmm. Everest climb. And I said, hey, these guys, we did a climb out in Moab, Utah, and the three of us was kind of GIMP helping GIMP. And it was this real kind of magical event out there, which was really cool.
I've always climbing the Fisher Tower.
Yeah, the Fisher Tower and Ancient Art. Mm-hmm. And it was this really fantastic climb. I'd like to get these two guys involved with what we're talking about. So I called Eric. I called Hugh. We ended up putting our first kind of little, in those days, it was more of a festival, we called it, instead of a summit. But we did it in the Dolomites, and it was a very obscure little place up in the mountains. This real beautiful location, but nothing was really accessible. I mean, the hotels weren't that accessible. Everything was kind of difficult to kind of put this together. But it was this real magical place in the mountains.
I remember the chair operators didn't even know how to get people with disabilities on the chairs.
They didn't have an idea. They didn't, yeah, they weren't.
On the ski lifts.
On the ski lifts, yeah, thank you. Yeah.
They weren't doing adaptive skiing in those days, I guess, in that little village. It was actually the home of the 1956 Olympics. So that was kind of my envision, was to kind of start this. And who knew that was going to kind of get into what it is today? It's just amazing what you guys have done. All the different things that No Barriers has to offer for people.
Yeah, what do you think about when you think about the evolution? You know, you had this little germ of an idea to go to this town and start talking about accessibility and innovation and sort of some of your lessons about how you've broken through barriers, or the three of us had broken through barriers. And now, like when you look at it today,
it's grown so big, and how many different people it affects. And it's not just the disabled community, it's able-bodied community, bringing everyone together, trying new experiences. The youth programs that you guys have been doing is tremendous over the years. Soldiers to the Summit, you know, we're having all these guys coming back doing, you know, 10 tours. They're not adjusting back into society very well, and taking them out into the outdoors, you know, with Jeff and different mountain guides. It just changes their lives and brings them more back into a reality where they can really kind of adjust back into society. Yeah. And then the summit is just, I love coming to the summits. I've been to every one now. I haven't missed one since the beginning. It's going to be fantastic in New York. I'm really looking forward to that.
And you bring your climbing wall, your portable climbing wall.
I'll have.
To every summit. So that's your mission now, right? To go around and use your climbing wall as a no barriers kind of tool to help people break through barriers. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Climbing's been such a big part of my life that I just like to kind of introduce different people to the sport. A lot of times somebody that's we don't say electric chair. Electric chair is something you die in. A power chair. A power chair takes you from point A to point B. There's not as many things out there for a power chair user to participate in. Climbing on my wall, they can. We have these harnessing systems that support your core. It's almost like a bosun's chair, pulley systems. So we can really, if you have the desire to get on the climbing wall, we can facilitate that. We don't turn anybody away. We've had people that weigh 500 pounds on my wall before. It doesn't matter. I had a gentleman that had spina bifida. He was, you know, unfortunately caught up in the American society of drinking a lot of soda and became really big. We got him on the wall. It was really difficult for him. You know, we would talk to him and he wouldn't really, like, look at you eye to eye as we were talking. I saw him a year later. He dropped 150 pounds, quit the soda, got into a training, cut his hair in a mohawk, and it just like changed his life. Got out of a power chair, was in a manual chair. So climbing was kind of the responsibility of really kind of changing this guy's life. And now I see him down in Los Angeles. I probably take the wall to Southern California maybe 7 or 8 times a year, San Francisco Bay Area. I sort of have different groups hire me year after year. Once they experience the wall, they really want to have it be part of their event. So we bring in mini LCAP, I call it, and we get people on it, and we have a great time.
And you're traveling around with your wall full time. People bring you in to, you know, create this experience for their, you know, rehab hospital or organization or team, right?
Exactly. All those venues. I do adaptive climbing seminars. So a gym might call me and want to know, how do we get an adaptive climbing program going? So I do that. And a lot of times I'll do not only a seminar on adaptive climbing, but then maybe that evening do kind of a show and tell about adventure sports and where adventure sports have taken the disabled in the last 35 years.
And you are like Kleenex now, because like you say, I when you talk about the pulley system, right? It's not a pulley system, pull-up system. Like a lot of people say, oh yeah, the Mark Wellman system.
It's kind of getting that way. And it's,
you're like Beyonce now.
I'm like Beyonce. So it's just kind of neat that, you know, my passions over the years, I mean, everybody should have a passion. And my passion has always been to be out camping, doing something in the outdoors, coming up with new ideas, new technologies. And, you know, some of these technologies is more like a backyard technology. It's not that fancy. Sometimes some of the most simplest things can change something, like mountain bike tires on a wheelchair can change a chair's getting into the backcountry tremendously. Mounting a pull-up bar on a sender can allow a paraplegic to do 7,000 pull-ups in 8 days to go up El Cap. Just simple little technologies can really change people's lives. And you can take that backyard technology, garage technology, put something together that works for you that can help a whole bunch of people.
Hmm. You've told us a story, sort of the arc of your life. And when I look at you, Mark, and think about what you've accomplished, I think, God, this is incredible. This is an incredible human being that very few people who had what happened to you would ever have chosen the path that you have chosen. And I think when I think about our No Barriers community, every so often you get folks who will say, well, yeah, well, that's Mark Wellman, but that couldn't have been me. Like, you're putting someone in front of me that's so incredible. Like, how could I possibly do this?
Yeah, you're demotivational. Yeah.
Right, right. So I know, I get it.
I'd love to hear, like, what do you think we can... Because this is what we do at No Barriers. We, if you're listening to this, it's not like we take everyone up mountains, but we try to remind them about something in their spirit teaches them anything is possible. And so talk to us a little bit about, like, Mark, how did you get to that point? Is it just sort of who you were from the beginning? Was it an evolution? Like, it just seems like everything you encountered, you're like, I can do more.
I think it's really important for people to get out of their comfort zone. And the outdoors has a way of getting you out of your comfort zone. And you can make it safe. You don't need to, you know, think about what I do. It's more about maybe getting some different experiences. And that's what's so cool about the summit, is you have all these different activities going on where you just get a little taste of it. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that little taste will inspire your imagination to want to try it again. And that's where I think it's really important if you're facilitating skiing or climbing or whatever you're facilitating, you have to make sure that these people, their first experience is a good one.
Last question for you from my end. This is Eric, and I want to know, like, so I've made it kind of clear that I look up to you, and tell me, who are the people that you look up to? Like, tell us about, like, that guy, Larry. Tell us about some people who influence your life.
Oh, man. There's been a lot, for sure. There was a guy named, actually, I think you're thinking of Mark Sutherland.
Yeah.
When I first got hurt, Mark was a quadriplegic for 10 years post to my injury, and he was back in the hospital. Some quadriplegics can move their arms and they can push manual chairs, and he was one of those. But he was losing some of his arm strength. So he was in the hospital, and my room was next to his, and we would talk at night because I was really bummed out. When I was first injured, to me, being a paraplegic was a fate worse than death. I was on the sixth floor. If I could have crawled over the window and jumped out, I would have, because that's how bad I felt. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, not having the use of my legs, I'm not going to ski again, I'm not going to climb. I was 22. It was just like, why didn't the mountain just take me? Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of thoughts I was having. But then I would go into this guy's room, Mark Sutherland, and he would talk about, oh, I had this milk truck that I converted, and I had a stool. One time I was driving it with my hand controls, and I fell off the stool, and I was on the ground, and I had to throw my hand on the brake to stop it so I didn't kill anybody.
And you were like, that's the greatest story ever.
Yeah, I want to do that. Yeah, yeah. So I was just hearing this stuff from this guy, and he was talking about girlfriends and how he was running around doing this and doing that, and I'm going, man, this guy has a life. Mm-hmm. And it was really inspiring to be so where I was really depressed and laying in the hospital bed, couldn't feel my lower extremities, and what's a catheter? And I'm just like, man, this is horrible. What did I get myself into? And then this guy was really upbeat and uplifting. And
showed you it wasn't a death sentence.
Yeah, right? Showed me it wasn't a death sentence, and let's get on with life, dude. Mm-hmm. And it was like, boom, and that just changed me. Mm-hmm. And I go, then we went into rehab together. We were more in a hospital setting. Then we both went into our physical rehab, and then that's when, man, it just started clicking for me, and that was it.
What if people want to learn how to get in touch with you, how to work with you, how to bring your wall to their organization?
Yeah, Google Mark Wellman, or just go to my website, nolimitstahoe.com. If you have ideas, let's talk about it. Let's see you at the summit. Let's get out and enjoy life.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Mark.
Listen, yeah. Mark, I know you well enough to know you don't need to hear what I'm about to tell you, but I think it's important for you and the listeners to know that in conversations like this, it becomes so clear how you are sort of the upside down pyramid, and you're the point on the upside down pyramid, and it all sort of funnels up from you, really. And I know there's others, but you mean you're the man. And I know it's important for you. It is important for me to know that you know how many thousands of lives you've impacted.
Tens of thousands.
Yeah. Thousands of lives, dude. Like, you have been the Kickstarter and the impetus, and you're just one of the, you know, most wonderful pioneers. And you know it, but you need to hear it more, because you're the man.
I appreciate it, man. It's humbling.
Well, it's been an honor to have you here, Mark. I know many of our listeners are part of that No Barriers tribe, and many of them will know you, but a lot of them won't, right? The movement's grown so big that it's well beyond you. But per what Jeff was saying, it's so important, I think, for the people of our community to know where this began. Mm-hmm. And you are the point that Jeff mentioned where it began. And so thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate having you.
My pleasure.
What did you guys take away from that?
Well,
might take us a while.
Yeah, exactly.
I need a lengthy debrief on that one.
I guess for me, as someone who's helping to build this movement, like I was ending with there, just to remember the roots of where No Barriers began, which is individuals coming together in small communities around creative ideas to do stuff that people didn't think was possible, right? And as we start to move to tens of thousands, maybe millions over the next 10 years of people we impact, that there's something in that special sauce that's still about the individuals getting together, having a fun, creative idea, and going out and pushing their comfort zone.
Yeah. I think the No Barriers recipe is sort of hidden right in the story of El Capitan, which is, you know, Mark's a smart guy, but he's not like a scientist or anything. He's not Hugh Herr, who's inventing stuff where you go, I could never do that, right? What he said is a pull-up bar and a Jumar. These are commercially available things. I think he had to adapt a few things, but, you know, not all that crazy technology. Pretty simple. You combine that, you know, series of that innovation with the human spirit and a great friend, right? Or a great support system, a great rope team. You do this amazing thing that, you know, opens up the door for a lot of people. I mean, it's a pretty simple recipe.
It is.
All the big things that have happened with regards to our species, you know, all sort of started with this small germination of somebody sitting in their theoretical garage just being like, how do I do this? And head scratch, and then start, you know, piecing these things together. And then, boom, the movement begins. And I think Mark embodies that. And it's what a great, you know, cornerstone for this organization.
Yeah.
Well, and the movement continues. So if you're sitting there listening and saying, I want to be a part of this organization, I want to be a part of No Barriers, please go to our website, nobarriersusa.org. You can join us at the summit that Mark mentioned that's coming up in October in New York. There are many more ways you can join us, but please, nobarriersusa.org is our website. You can also share our podcast with your friends and colleagues and families and follow us on our Facebook page. Thank you so much for listening.
Live No Barriers.
Thanks.